listening to Regional Originals, a Masters of the Stage podcast. Regional Originals is a series of interviews with some of the most exciting directors and choreographers working in America's regional theater today.
Hi, I'm M. Graham Smith, and this is Masters of the Stage, Regional Originals, brought to you by the SDC Foundation. Our guest today is Nataki Garrett. Nataki Garrett is the Associate Artistic Director of Denver Center for the Performing Arts Theater Company, formerly the Associate Artistic Director of CalArts Center for New Performance. Nataki is a member of Woolly Mammoth Theater Company, a recipient of the NEA TCG Career Development Program for Directors, and a member of SDC. Nataki Garrett is co-artistic director of Blank the Dog Productions, BTD, an LA, New York City-based ensemble theater company which is celebrating its 10th year and is dedicated to developing and fostering new work by emerging, adventurous, and experimental artists. Garrett recently opened two new plays, Blacks by Aziza Barnes at Steppenwolf and Jefferson's Garden by Timberlake Wortenbaker at Ford's Theater in D.C. She remounted an Octoroon by Brandon Jacobs Jenkins at Woolly Mammoth Theater Company after its initial smash hit run in June of 2016. In 2008, Garrett received an NAACP Theater Award nomination for Best Director for Black Woman State of the Union, an evening of plays by Black women. Garrett has directed for Skylight Theater Company, Lower Depths Theater, The Matrix Theater Company, Watts Village Theater Company, The Company of Angels, Celebration Theater Company, Red Cat, CalArts CNP, CalArts School of Theater, Pomona College, Occidental College, Pasadena Playhouse, and many more. She has worked internationally in Bellagio, Italy, Edinburgh, Scotland, Paris, France, and in Rwanda and Uganda. Her work can be heard on the radio through LA TheaterWorks Audio Theater Collection for NPR, recorded live at the Skirball Cultural Arts Center, and now on our program, Masters of the Stage Regional Originals as well. Welcome, Nataki. It's so good to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
The first question I have to ask you is about Blacks, your production at Steppenwolf by Aziza Barnes. I've never seen a vision of theater like that living on stage before. It seemed somehow so much better or more than a play. It seemed to break all the rules of how a play should feel. It seemed like a play, stand-up comedy, and performance art all happening at the same time. And there was an upside-down couch with pillows falling off of it, floating above the stage the whole time. I had the time of my life. I didn't know that the theater could take me. So can you tell us how you approached this play and how you brought that vision to life?
So Aziza Barnes is a poet turned playwright, and I think that there's something really quite prolific and telling about Aziza's way of writing, the way Z attacks a world, the way Z sees a world. When I first read this play, five pages in, I thought, I have to direct it. I said yes right away. And this was to direct the reading at OHI Playwrights Conference a couple of years ago. My approach was to look for the intersection between this clearly, you know, millennial mind, a millennial way of looking at the world, questions posed through the lens of a millennial experience that all felt pretty timeless. Not to equalize or even diminish the difference between the people who the play represented and myself, but I could see myself in their experience with the one very important difference. The very, very important difference for me was I had never experienced writing that was so unapologetically Black, where the demands on the status quo to be present and to be indicted because of their presence, or to be clarified as being present, where those demands were relinquished, and what could emerge was who we are in our complexity in these moments when we're just with ourselves. Really something that has to do with where I believe this burgeoning generation is taking us, which is, you know, to quote Oscar Wilde, be yourself, everyone else is already taken.
Yes.
To 100% be yourself. And so my approach was, in that moment, in these moments of really becoming who you are, there are all these moments where you question your path and the effect that you have on other people. The play itself takes place in New York City.
Yeah.
And if you're not from New York City, you usually move to New York City because of somebody else's nostalgia. Right. Somebody right. said, oh, when I lived in New York, I had this experience. And, you know, you're looking at the video now, projection footage, the recorded footage of 9 million people crossing the street in bell bottoms, you know, in mm-hmm. the 70s, or the scourge that is... was Times Square, you know, when I first moved there was the beginning of the change at time, in Times Square, or hearing, you know, songs about New York, you know, the punk scene and downtown and Alphabet City and, you know, the hip hop scene and the Bronx. And those are all, you're nostalgic for all of those moments. Yes. Because New York is one of the most fictionalized cities in the world. And so that was the intersection between Z's world and my experience moving to New York City with, you know, $500 and a hole in my shoe mm-hmm. in the middle of winter. You know, what the convergence was is I will move here and I will be a person and I will get my sofa off the side of the road and cart it to my house and furnish an entire apartment from people's discards and, you know, figure out how to live in the machine that is the metropolis of New York. And that's sort of the beauty of the play is, you know, day in the life of these young black women who are trying to figure out, like, how do you live in this big machine?
Yeah.
And who are we? And can we survive these moments? You know.
That was, yeah. It was so beautiful to see. So speaking of your, you know, arrival in New York, I wonder if you could take us back and just help us know kind of where you began your relationship with the theater mm-hmm. and how you found your way eventually to the Denver Theater Center.
So it goes way back because I was raised in the Bay Area. And so I remember Drama Studio London. My mother couldn't afford to put me into their program. It was a youth theater, and I saw production of Guys and Dolls. It was the first time it occurred to me that you could be a kid and stand on stage and do those things. Like, I don't know, I never put it, you know, I saw Swan Lake when I was four, mm-hmm. and I started ballet lessons the next week, you know?
Yeah.
But it never occurred to me that, like, just didn't make the connection between, like, what kids could do and what those other people could do.
Right.
Until I saw the work at Drama Studio London in Berkeley. And then the next time I remember being really conscious of theater, outside of, you know, being in all the church plays, or, you know, taking all of the dance classes. My mother had me in every after-school program from the time I was six until, you know, until I graduated high school. I remember going to Berkeley Rep, and now I go back. I've been back on their site to try to see what that production was, but I remember it was an O'Neill, and there was a boat, like a rowboat.
Yep.
And there was a child playing a role, and in this big, meaty, adult drama, yep. you know, I remember feeling like this little white kid, this white boy, like I remember feeling like I'm going to go on his journey and being really conscious
wow.
of it, right? And I know it was an O'Neill or some sort of prolific writing like that, some sort of big, meaty, juicy, you know, like steak and potatoes writing.
Uh-huh. And there was this little window.
Yeah,
this.
That I was like, oh, I could go on that journey. And that's where I can find myself. And we went there, you know, I was with my junior high or high school. I think it was junior high because I think we stopped going when I was in ninth grade. But I went to Berkeley School, so we were at Berkeley Rep on a regular basis.
Great.
And so that was my point of entry. And then I was in drama classes because I quit swimming and stopped dancing. And that all seemed to converge at the same time. So I took my first acting class in the ninth grade, and I was hooked. Years later, I, you know, went to college, and I was going to leave the school. I went to Virginia Union University, which is a historically black college. I was going to leave because they didn't have a drama program, or because it was too small, or because I thought I knew everything, or, you know, whatever those reasons are when you're that age and you're just trying to figure out who you are. And Dr. Williams, who was a graduate of Virginia Union, restarted the drama program, and I got to be kind of a whale in a puddle, you know,
wow.
Because I could bring my experience from high school theater. I was one of the few that had that experience, and he let me do whatever I wanted. So I coiled cable, and I hung lights, and I also directed, and I also acted, and I assisted him, and I did all the things. And then I went to the Alliance Theatre Company right after college to work with Kenny Leon. I believe it was his second year as the artistic director at the Alliance. So it was like that big change where he's trying to change a, you know, gigantic ship, to change mm-hmm. course, to bring it about in these ideas that the theatre could be more inclusive, that, you know, that you could invite all different kinds of people into the space by changing the programming or utilizing the same programming but changing the casting, or, you know, those early ideas about multiculturalism. I was in their apprentice program and their internship program, and I was the first to be both a stage manager intern and a directing apprentice. And the only reason why I wanted to be a stage manager was so I could watch directors.
Yeah.
And I knew pretty early that I was a director. And I remember being on stage once when I was in the Bay Area, and I was playing Behringer and Rhinoceros.
Okay.
And I was in the middle of working, and all of a sudden, like, I could feel that I was not acting. And what I was doing was making the other person react to me. And once I like, I once it, you know, cause the director was like, why isn't this working? And I was like, I don't know. I'm, you know, doing all the things you said, but I wasn't in my body in those moments. And I remember adjusting myself and changing my tone and watching what the other actor did. And once it got known, it could not be unknown. Like, I was so conscious of doing it. So I feel like I'd been a director for a while, even though I was still performing. And then I left Atlanta after the internship was over. I met the new artistic director here at the Denver Center, Chris Coleman.
Yes.
I was the stage manager for a piece that he did, I think it was Harvey Milk.
Okay.
In 1996.
Wow.
And then I moved out of Atlanta because nobody there thought I was a director. And I got the sense that if I wanted to remain in stage management, I could probably make a career. But every time I told somebody I was a director, people would literally laugh at me. And so I just knew I had to go. So I moved to New York with $500 and ended up with this group of people. And we would build these little theater things, these performance moments, and perform them in the Lower East Side.
Oh, amazing.
And I remember having a conversation with, you know, I remember making a meeting with Linda Chapman at New York Theater Workshop, and was like, I'm a director. I just wanted to introduce myself to you. I just arrived in New York. You know, I was like, you know, 24, 25, one of those, you know, in that time when you're like, you know, I'm just going to announce myself as if I am something,
yeah,
you know,
why not?
Doing something. And she didn't, she could have really completely treated me like crap, but she didn't. You know, she let me come back to her office. She invited me to do an internship, and I couldn't because I had to work 3 jobs in order to live in New York. And I remember shortly after I turned down that opportunity, and I remember feeling like, what does it mean when you're so disenfranchised that your tenacity got you the opportunity, but you can't take advantage of it?
Right,
because you have to have other resources in order to do that. And I've always been really, really aware of the people who get to take those opportunities and why. Because, you know, my mom was a teacher, you know, and my dad was, I wasn't raised with my dad. He was a revolutionary anyway, so, you know, they didn't have any money. And I'm, you know, I'm black, just in case if you're listening. And so what that meant to me was that there was no track record of what I was trying to do with my career. You know, there weren't any black women who were, like, there weren't a mass of black women who were doing it. There was Ellen Stewart, right?
Yeah.
And that's like it.
Yeah.
And so it was like my own tenacity to be even thinking I could pursue this career. And so really me being really, really angry that I couldn't take that internship opportunity, and being really, like, clearly aware of the limits of growing up without any money in those moments. And Linda said to me, you know, kid, you're going to have to go to grad school if you're going to call yourself a director. And I was like, I'm not going to grad school, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Liz LeCompte didn't go. You know, like, I had my list of directors, women who didn't go. And she was like, well, if anybody's going to take you seriously, you have to go. And I fought the idea for a few months. And sometimes you have those moments where something is given to you and you're like, no, you're stupid. And then the only reason why they're stupid is because they're so smart and you had to hear it and you didn't want to.
And you didn't think of it first, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I applied, and then I ended up going to CalArts for grad school. And even then I thought, oh, I'll go for a year, because they gave me this little teeny scholarship that was, you know, I was like, I don't have any money. So I don't have any money and I'm still paying back my undergrad, because the only way I could go to college was on loans. How did I get here? So I went to CalArts, and I graduated from CalArts, and a couple of years later, I'm the first student to graduate from CalArts that they asked back to come and teach. I was there through the end of my ninth year, so working on my 10th year. So I say I was there for 10 years, but yeah. It was really 9 years. And the previous 6 years before I left, I was the associate dean of the School of Theater and the co-head of undergraduate acting. So I'd moved into administrative positions and also the associate artistic director of the Center for New Performance. And I really loved teaching when I loved it, and I was glad to leave when I left. I didn't want to be one of those teachers that didn't love teaching.
Yeah.
And I looked for an organization that was comparable in terms of the amount of output, the amount of work they did. I don't think any place is comparable in budget.
Sure.
But comparable in terms of, you know, like doing a 12-show season on the main stage is like, you know, I just shrugged my shoulders. It's like nothing.
You're like, yeah.
Yeah, I could do that all day. Yeah. And so I only applied to two places, and Denver Center was one of them, and I got the job here.
Great. Do you think that you have a driving impulse or a mission that motivates your work?
Yes, I do. And if anything, this season at the Denver Center is a good representation of that. When you exist in a body like mine in the world, your sense of being excluded is heightened, because the challenge is to figure out ways of being included in spaces where your entering into those spaces is a revolution.
Yeah.
And so what I look for in the work that I do is I'm interested in the silenced voices, the people who don't have voice, in providing opportunities and platforms for those voices to be heard. I'm interested in the craziest possible idea, unstageable, unthinkable, can't happen anywhere near a stage, why would you do that kind of crazy stuff. And I'm interested in a multitude of experiences, to experience everything. My mission as an artistic director is to allow for this now kind of common reflection on our stages, which is what we're now calling diversity. On our stages, a diversity representing all kinds of experiences and backgrounds, to also be reflected in our audiences. So I'm looking for the things that bring people together. And for me, what I'm happy to say out loud that I believe is a part of that is to relinquish some space. So some of the work that I'm interested in might cause people to want to vacate the building. And what that offers is a space for people who want to remain and a space for people who want to come in. And so I'm always looking for those. Like, what does it mean for different elbows to rub on those seats? You know,
yes.
Like, what does that mean?
Yes.
And I think that's my defining mission now. How often can I create opportunities for people from disparate experiences to come together and see themselves together in a space? How do I do that?
That's so important. I feel like there's so many forces at work dividing us into groups. To have that shared experience is really powerful. I want to ask you about the implementation of that vision. One of the things, your work focuses on new plays and new voices, and I want to go back to Aziza's play, Blacks. Mm-hmm. In a lot of equity, diversity, and inclusion trainings that I've had the benefit of being part of, the remaining obstacle, even when a white establishment invites artists of color to the table, is that it's the establishment's table. And so how do you address those inequities, like, for example, in your creative process?
Mm-hmm.
How does that work when you want to make space for everyone to feel like they can offer something in a creative way,
mm-hmm.
But those inequities are built into the room?
Well, and I think that's what the challenge is it's what I've said here at the Denver Center, and what I think is being experienced with the work that Steppenwolf is doing, is you've got to allow it to be frictious first. You know, two forces that believe that they're opposed have to come together to find that they're actually the same.
Yes.
Right? And so you have to provide the opportunity for that to happen. One of the things that I, for Blacks in particular, my concerns was that what happens when you present young, Black, queer, female, right, in a space that has very little of any of those, often enough for it to be a normal thing for people to experience, is you give people opportunity to be gawking and voyeuristic in their experience. And I was not interested in that. So my thing was to empower the cast to be in complete control of their bodies, to be in complete control of their image and to be empowered to draw the line, you know, to take up space. But also, you know, we had a moment during one of the previews where the people who Aziza says that they wrote the piece for, those people were in the house. And they were doing the things that those people do, right? These sisters were talking and they were communicating, you know, their experience of what they were seeing out loud in the moment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these are all, if you grow up Black in America, these are sort of normal parts of how we exist, right? In a house that was completely devastated by the fact that you would walk in a house, you know, 15 minutes late and start talking. Mm-hmm. And so this, they were shushed a couple of times. And then this, at the end of the play, this white woman crossed the aisle and went over there to, I think she was going to be really generous in her offering about how you behave in space. And I wasn't sitting near them. I was sitting up in the rafters with my assistant, and I watched the woman cross, and I watched the rearing up in the preparation for a clapback, and the clapback happened before she landed, you know, where the sister said, you could hear it because she was loud about it. She said, "It took me 45 minutes to get here by train to a neighborhood I might be arrested in for being in, to see a play that it was about me. And you're going to come over here and tell me how to behave in this house? I didn't come here for that." It was so clear. And by the time, you know, like I finished my notes with my assistant, by the time we were done, I looked back over there and that woman who had crossed the aisle was on her knees so that she could be in a position to communicate, right? So that there could be a possibility of exchange. Well, the friction was important. She needed to cross the aisle and the sister needed to clap back, and the theater needed to witness it. And the result was Z was asked to write something, an insert. Mm-hmm. And even that was, it took some pains to get, you know, Z wrote it. Mm-hmm. And then the theater had to decide whether or not they could take it.
Yes.
You know, they were like, well, it's, you know, Z was like, no, this is for us by us. And and folks at the theater were like, no, it's for everybody. And Z was like, no, no, you actually get the privilege of witnessing.
Yes. It's a beautiful note. Do you mind if I just read some of it that the folks can hear? So this is the note in the program. It said, "This is a play by Black people and for Black people. The absurd, the treacherous, the disgust, the heartbreak, the gorgeous of our days. I'm inviting Black people to live fully here, those on stage and off. For y'all that don't fit that description, take your lead from the people that do. And in the words of Richard Pryor, let's just all calm down and enjoy whatever the fuck happens."
Yeah, that's exactly. And it was tough because this idea that, you know, Z drew a line. And so this is, you know, like we get the privilege of witnessing y'all on a regular basis.
Yes.
You get the privilege of witnessing us one time. That's all we're asking for, is the one time.
Yeah.
You know, of course, where Z is concerned, I'm sure that there's, you know, 40 more times to follow in the next year.
Yes.
But this one time. And that's what I think, that's about that play. Like, that's where it comes from, is the spirit of, no, I deserve this space. Like, I'm going to take it. I'm taking this space.
Were
By the way, it belongs to me anyway.
That's right.
Yeah.
Were there strategies in the way that you kind of conceived of the experience and the direction of the piece, just in terms of the way you staged it or the way the design worked, that also kind of supported the kind of thing that Z was talking about in that note?
I think so, and it's also because my process is really inclusive, and I know everybody says they're collaborative, but what I mean by collaborative is, even if you're not collaborative, I'm still collaborative, so mm-hmm. I'm still going to figure out a way to work with you. And so I like to offer my creative team, as much room as possible to dream and imagine. For example, with Sybil and that space, Sybil Wickesheimer, I said, you know, Z said something the other day about, like, that one discarded couch, and then this is the result, right? And what I in the meantime, there were a lot of questions and conversations between Sybil and I, but I didn't say I wanted what she built. what I said was, there's this idea in the world, and I just want to see, like, what this does. And, you know, she had a few incarnations, and then this explosion, which for a while we were all afraid was going to be too heavy and surreal for the language mm-hmm. of the play. So I kind of have to trust that, for me, the process isn't, I have an idea for you to execute. For me, the process is, I have an idea, and I'd love to bang my idea up against your idea for a little while, and then we can see if there's something there, you know. And then let's see what happens if we, like, you know, projections came really late in the process. It was mm-hmm. something we had spoken about, but I think we were all kind of back-footing it. And then we brought Devante in, and something about Devante's mind created the space for the opportunity for the projections, right? So I had some ideas, but it was Devante that created that prolific, you know, the moving imagery, this feeling of moving through New York City, that came out of, I'm sure it came out of some of our conversations, but I like this idea that it came mostly out of Devante's spirit.
That's
you
great.
Know, and that my job is to have a convening of those ideas and to see how, like, I might be the one that takes all the puzzle pieces and makes it into an image, but the puzzle pieces have their own lives, you know, and their own ideas and imaginations.
I would love to talk a little bit about Denver. You're our first guest who is representing the Rocky Mountain region,
yes.
and this program is all about directors working in the region. So I wonder how would someone who's worked in so many different regions and lived in so many different regions, how would you characterize this region of theater in America? What defines it?
Well, I first have to talk a little bit about the region itself, because I arrived in Denver a year ago. And it was in the process of what it's doing right now, which is there's an explosion of the population. People are moving here in record numbers. At some point, it was like 5,000 people were moving to Denver a month.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the top cities for millennials to move to. It's one of the few cities that has a low unemployment rate. It is the test market city. It is where people come and train to Olympic athletes, you know, to do triathlons and run marathons. It is that city. And so I believe that there are two Denvers. I think that there is, like, that Denver that's, like, getting fat and swelling and becoming, you know, unwieldy in a way, which is kind of beautiful to witness, especially since I'm not from the Rocky mm-hmm. Mountain region. And then there's this, like, sort of provincial Denver that believes it can only see itself in the way that it's always seen itself.
Uh-huh.
And so the Denver Center right now is in this sort of battle between those two worlds, right?
Sure.
Because it is a regional theater, which means it serves its public, which means that there are whole groups of people who are invited, I quote that, but not necessarily shown the path to get to the door.
Sure.
And then there are people who have been here, dug in, who are the sort of holders of the Denver Center, been here for 37 years, and, you know, they were the first ever play to be produced, you know, like those people. And I think what's going to happen in these next few years in the Rocky Mountains is that there's going to be an explosive coming together of those two populations. And the Denver Center is in this place, this really remarkable place where it has to decide, you know, is it going to lend itself to what's coming, or is it this other thing? At the base of it, though, these people go to the theater. Theater is a part of the Denver experience. You know, high schools come to the theater, and they do it on a regular basis. Theater for them is like both Broadway and theater company, so it's not like just going to see the big road shows. It's
right.
like, it's a really important part of this community.
Maybe we should just mention how the Denver Center works, because it's kind of unique in that it does have this Broadway touring program as
yeah.
well as producing works that you incubate and develop here.
Yeah. So the Denver Center for the Performing Arts is the umbrella under which there are several different entities. So there's Broadway division, there's theater company, there's facilities, the Sewell Ballroom, and the, you know, like renting out spaces for conferences and that kind of a thing. There's education is another one. Off-center is one. These are all separate things that are inside of the umbrella of the Denver Center. So it's run by a CEO, and then each of those little areas has their own leader. And there's a lot of convergence because we are a producing organization on the theater company side, and that what that means is that we produce basically anything that's going to be produced is produced through through theater company. On the Broadway side, that's I think that our Broadway houses are part of the League of Presenters. And so sometimes we have shows start here, like the Frozen that's going to Broadway started here.
Yes.
And some things we have things move through here, like Hamilton is moving through here to go someplace else. So both exist. But on theater company, on the theater company side, we develop new plays and we produce existing works. And up until Kent's departure last March, there had been a real kind of clear focus on classically presented classical material. And that's a part of Kent's aesthetic. He came from Alabama Shakespeare
Festival. Kent Thompson.
Kent Thompson, yes. Who is the reason why I'm here.
Yeah.
He's the one who brought me here. And so, and then with Chris coming, there is another kind of focus on classically presented material.
That's great. Mm-hmm. You know, you brought, so that you were talking about the transition here at Denver Center, and we're in a huge moment of leadership transition across the American theater landscape. And there's a big opportunity in that transition. If you could whisper any advice into the ears of all the boards across this country that are in the midst of making decisions about leadership, would there be any advice or suggestions or anything you'd want to whisper to them?
A whisper.
a whisper on public broadcast.
Whisper through a megaphone. I believe that most boards would say that they are charged with the task of shepherding theaters so that they can continue to exist, especially right now, you know, with the attacks on the NEA and the attacks on funding for the arts. And there are going to be a number of theaters who are going to want to remain with the status quo. And the status quo comes in a lot of forms. And so most recently, Pam McKinnon was announced, and I'm so happy for Pam. At ACT, that's going to be so brilliant, but I'm not ready to throw the parade, because out of the last, you know, so it's like four or five out of the last 20, which means that we're still working with the same numbers. 25% of Lort theaters are run by women. Only one of them is run by a woman of color, and I'm not even sure if that particular woman. I've never had a conversation with her, so I don't know. But I don't know if that particular woman is of color identified or not. We have a long way to go before we're fully representing. I think the other thing is that there's going to be a convergence between like Black Lives Matter, the Me Too movement, and Time's Up. You know, like, because the fact that I'm here and was instrumental in making sure that the season that we're in right now happened, could program a season and the summit is not because I got lucky and bold to strike on my first time out. So these are skill sets that I have been cultivating for my entire career. And I have been moving through the pipeline, which is what some of us who have been connected to TCG were calling whatever this, you know, you go through grad school and you go into one of these programs that TCG offers, and it's supposed to prepare you. But you can't say that the pipeline is broken if you don't utilize it.
That's right.
You know, and I'm all for the people who circumvent the pipeline, but if you're not going to use the pipeline, then you're wasting people's time. Mm-hmm. And there's so much talent. When the announcement started, like flooding, you know, like last summer, it was like seven at a time. People were leaving their theaters, and I started saying to as many women, particularly women of color, that I could get in my midst, apply for the job. Mm-hmm. I don't care if you don't want the job. Apply for it anyway. Apply for the jobs, because at least they need to know, these boards need to know, that they can't just say anymore that there weren't enough of, you know, we tried, we had one good solid candidate. Flood their pools with you so that they can begin to see what's possible, and then they'll broaden their perspective. The last thing I'll say about
please,
that is...
Please.
Everybody I know who's running a theater right now, these older white dudes, all of them were like 25.
That's right.
And somebody said to them, you look like you should be able to do this. Here's X amount of dollars. and the keys to the Magic Kingdom,
mm-hmm.
right? You look like you should be able to do it. Some of us don't look like that. Some of us aren't going to be 25.
Yeah.
Right? Some of us look like me, and I'm 46 years old, and I look like I'm 25, and you think, oh, there's no way, you know, because she looks too young to be able to do it. But remember who you brought on board the first time around.
Right.
And what you took to cultivate that person into being the leader that they became.
Yeah.
And if you were to give those opportunities to women and people of color on a regular basis, it wouldn't feel so strange to have to look across the table at somebody like me and think, yeah, this is the one I want to run this thing.
That's right.
You know, that's my tiny little whisper into a megaphone.
That's fantastic. Thank you. What do you see ahead as some of the challenges for the field and for these leaders who are going to be taking on these huge institutions? And as you say, we've seen a steady decline in foundation money over mm-hmm. the last 20 years. What are the big things facing these folks that are going to be accepting these jobs?
I believe that that the boards have to be willing to listen to the next generation. I think that they're just like they're like Zelda Fitzchandler was not. She was not in a revolutionary moment. She started a revolution, right? And
yes.
somebody listened to her. And somebody was like, oh, that sounds great. Let's, you know, you're crazy. Let's try it.
Let's do it.
Right? And I wonder how many of those ideas are out there. We're utilizing 20th century methodology in the 21st century. And because we're not mining down generations, we don't know what the 21st century methodology is that'll help to bring us forward. Because we're still saying, oh, well, you know, we started on this subscriber model thing. It's the only thing left.
Yeah.
No, it's a thing that you've been doing, but there are other things to do,
yes.
right? If you think of Blockbuster and Netflix, like if you think of podcasts, if you think of anything that was created since 2000, you know,
right.
I don't know why theater doesn't see itself that way. I got a few ideas, and I know I'm not alone.
Yeah,
you know, there are a few more of us who are like, I got some ways that we might be able to turn this thing around.
Yes.
You just have to trust. And be willing to take a risk in those directions.
Yes.
I don't know. I mean, you know, the beautiful thing about living in a democracy, at least up until now, is that every 4 years, you know, there's an opportunity to bring somebody else. You know,
yeah.
So right now there are all these threats. You know, maybe in 4 years there won't be. Maybe in four more years there will be. There's always been a threat. There's always been a threat to the arts. And we've managed to get through it.
Yeah.
It's how we get through it now, and are we willing to listen to somebody else
yeah.
tell us what we might do?
I'm from the Bay Area, and one of the things that the tech world has been teaching the Bay Area is that if you're a company, you need to almost completely reinvent yourself every 5 years in order to stay current. And
if you're an artist, you need to do that as well.
That's right.
But the boards don't do that, and I think part of that is because the boards don't see themselves artistically or in the way that a creative person has to reinvent. A board doesn't have to reinvent. And I think that that's probably to their detriment, that if they're not going back and restoking their fires and reminding themselves of why they're connected to this place in the first place, you know, if they're not even willing to, you know, to move towards risk, the only way to get through this time, risk is here.
Yeah.
So you got to move through it.
Yes.
When I arrived at the Denver Center, somebody said, you know, there are much better places to program that are going to be much more popular. And I said, great. That's awesome. Give me the list of popular places to program. And I'll program the hell out of that list. And I'm telling you, there are still only going to be 12 people in the audience.
Yeah.
That it's not about popular. How do you know what people want? You don't.
Yes.
You have to listen to people, and you have to listen to your heart, and you have to listen to the playwrights, and you have to listen to the artists, and you have to listen to the probability that it's all going to fail.
Yes.
And then you still got to do it anyway. And that's how you make theater.
And that's actually why you're special as an artistic leader, right? That's why artistic leaders are artistic leaders,
yeah.
is because they're actually anticipating what the future is, and they have an instinct about how to move through that risk.
Yeah. And we're experiencing something really funny here at the Denver Center. There's a play up right now that took off, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the one play in the season that I was told by my amazing marketing team. So I don't want to
sure.
crap on them, but that they were like, there's no way we can sell this.
And yeah, everyone knows that there's always a play like this
right,
in every
like,
company's season.
We can't sell. This is the only one we can. We can't sell it in that space. And they were like, they had a list of things that were going to work. And I was like, great. So what you're saying to me is that there is a marketing strategy that hasn't been invented yet to sell this thing. But I know it can be sold.
Yes.
Right? I have to trust my instincts on that, right? Because it could have all been a complete bomb. And then there's another play that is taking off like wildfire around the country. It's going to be one of those like super produced plays, mm-hmm. right? That's not doing terribly well here with our audiences, right? And so I am willing to risk one and the other because
yep.
I believe that they're both important. Those voices are important. But I also believe that later on, the organization will be thankful that it started here.
Yeah.
That voice started here.
Yes.
You know?
Unfortunately, we're almost out of time, and I could spend all day talking to you because your intelligence and passion is so addictive. But, you know, I wonder if you have any advice for young directors who are beginning their careers or beginning to think about, you know, do I need to go to grad school or not? Is there any advice that you would offer to those seeking this career?
So the best advice I ever received was from my mentor, and he said, I was worried about graduating and not having any opportunities post-graduation, and he said, never make your choice out of money. Don't worry about the money. The money will come. And never plan your opportunities around fame, because fame comes because of the kind of work that you do, not because you created fame for yourself. And those are the two bad, like, I was like, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
It's a business of relationships, and who you are in every single room counts. It matters. And so go to grad school or don't. Go through one of these pipeline programs or don't. But make your relationships and choose them wisely and nurture those relationships, because that pays off, you know, in dividends. Like, it's where I am now is only a result of my willingness to walk into a room and announce myself in front of somebody who understood that they could have demolished me in that moment, or they could have helped me rise, and they chose the latter, and that's a relationship that I still maintain in my heart today, that it taught me a lot about who I am as a mentor and as an artist and as a lover of this craft.
That's a beautiful place to end. Before we sign off, do you have any upcoming projects this coming like late spring or summer that you can share with folks who might want to come and check out what you're doing on stage?
Yeah, I have a piece that's going up at the Red Cat in May of this year, and that's called Carolyn Bryant. It was a piece that was originally created by me and my theater company, Blank the Dog, about the woman for whom Emmett Till was murdered in 1955.
Mm.
So that's coming up in May. And then we're remounting, I wonder if I can say this. I'm sure by the time this airs, they will have it. But Blacks is coming back. I'll say that.
Yes.
But that won't be until the winter of 2019.
Okay.
And then I probably have a couple of other projects in between.
Great. Well, you have a website, so folks can check in with that and find out what's going on.
NatakiGarrett.com.
Great. Natakhi, thank you so much for spending a little time with us this afternoon.
Thank you for having
wonderful.
Me. It's been amazing.
Thanks.
This podcast was brought to you by SDC Foundation. SDC Foundation events and programs are designed to offer access, opportunity, and community to directors and choreographers at all levels of their career. To find out more, you can go to our website at www.sdcfoundation.org.